I just put some formulas up, some reference formulas summarizing last time. So we were talking about a time-dependent Hamiltonian that looks like a frequency-dependent harmonic oscillator to lowest order plus an interaction term, where I forgot to write this down, but I'm assuming that the at early times the frequency goes to a constant, so that we know what the ground state of the system is. It's just an ordinary time-independent harmonic oscillator at early times. And I'm also assuming at early times that we start in the vacuum state of that time-independent harmonic oscillator. The solution of this theory in the last time I said in the Heisenberg picture without the H1 term, but you could just as well say in the interaction picture, the solution of the interaction of the equations of motion for the interaction picture operators is given by this expression, where V is the solution of the classical equation of motion for the time-dependent harmonic oscillator with these initial conditions. Once you have solved the theory in the interaction picture, you can compute the, we have this NN formula that tells you how to compute any expectation value at time t. To lowest order, you just compute in the interaction picture. You take the interaction picture operator and compute its expectation value in the ground state. And then there's a term that tells you the leading order correction says that you integrate and take the expectation value of the commutator of your observable and hi at an earlier time t prime, where hi is the interaction Hamiltonian h1 written in the interaction picture. Okay, great. So let's compute stuff. Of course, the physical system that I really want to talk about is the early universe during inflation, but let me just start with a 1D problem. Let's say an ordinary Schrodinger equation quantum mechanics problem. Let's say I start with the time-dependent harmonic oscillator, and I put in a little pulse. Whose Hamiltonian is proportional to p cubed. So you can imagine that epsilon of t here maybe is some function, some pulse that turns on for a short time. After the early times where omega goes to omega naught and before the time when we make the measurement. So I'd like to compute, just as an example of how to use the formulas. What happens when you turn this pulse on? Well, one thing that happens is it breaks the x to minus x symmetry. Without this term, there's a symmetry of the system that exchanges x and minus x and p and minus p. And so whatever wave function you get as you evolve is always symmetric. But this p cubed term is pushing the particle in a preferred direction. And so at late times, after the pulse happens, x will acquire an expectation value. So I'll just compute this to first order and epsilon. This is 0 to at zeroth order. Okay. So to compute this, let's say we start. This is at some time t. The zeroth order term is zero as expected. X sub I is a linear combination of A and A dagger, and that will always give zero when you sandwich it between two ground states. The second term There's a little trick here. So I have a commutator of an xi at time t with a pi cubed at time t prime. Let me just observe. That commutator, of course, is the difference of two terms. But here's the first term. But let me just observe that the second term, in the second term, I would exchange these two guys, which would give me the complex conjugate of whatever expectation value I had here. The minus I, and then I also get a minus sign from the commutator. And so that gives plus I in front instead of minus I. So the role of the second term is just to give me the complex conjugate of whatever's here. That'll ensure that the answer is real, as it is because I'm evaluating the expectation value over, as it has to be because I'm evaluating the expectation value of a Hermitian operator. Okay. Now to calculate this expectation value, so it's generally true if I'm calculating a ground state expectation value of a harmonic oscillator, that I can do this using a Wicks theorem like, I'll drop the zero. This is a statement about harmonic oscillators. Okay. If I have a chain of operators sandwiched between two ground states of the harmonic oscillator, and if each operator in the chain is a linear combination of A and A dagger, then the way I compute the expectation value is by using a Wicks theorem-like procedure where I just contract, I sum over all contractions. In this case, there are three different contractions. You know, you can contract the x with any of the p's. There are three ways of doing that, and then there's another contraction which is determined. Of course, all three ways of, where the meaning of the contraction, if I contract two operators, is that I just, the contraction is just the expectation value that I would get if these were the only operators. In other words, I keep the coefficient of A dagger in the operator on the right and the coefficient of A in the operator on the left. There are three contractions here, but each one of them gives the same result, they're all equivalent, so I can just put a minus three, and I can just put a factor of three in front. Okay. So this gives minus three I. Let's evaluate the contraction, I keep the coefficient of A, this for this first contraction. I keep the coefficient of A in the xi, that's v. The coefficient of A dagger in the p, that's v dot star. Oh, sorry, this is a t. This one is a t, this one is a t prime. Then for the second contraction, I keep the coefficient of A in the pi, which is v dot, and the coefficient of A dagger in the other p, which is v prime. That's the answer. Let me just, in the last step, I'll go ahead and put in the complex conjugate. Let's see. Since I have v dot times v dot star, I'll write that as, that's real, I'll write that as v dot t prime squared. Times v at t dot at t prime minus t star. And if I had a specific form for omega of t, then I could solve and get a specific form for v if I had a specific form for the pulse epsilon, I could put that in. But let me leave this the answer in this general form, since it's just sort of a toy example to illustrate the formal structure of how these calculations work. Okay. Now let me do a QFT example. Okay. So the field theory problem that I want to do I'm going to look at the generation of perturbations in this language for a massless scalar field on a non-dynamical De Sitter metric. So I'm just so I'm not considering the Gijs of the metric to be dynamical degrees of freedom. I'm just fixing that background and letting a massless scalar field evolve. So the action for a general metric, the action would look like this. This is this is the minimal coupling. I guess other couplings would be possible. I could have put minimal coupling in the description. So let's see what we get when we specialize to the De Sitter metric. So the De Sitter metric, or at least in the expanding patch of global De Sitter, the De Sitter metric is just the FRW metric with constant H. So the scale factor, let's work that out. So in proper time, the scale factor, Friedman's equation reads that the time derivative of log A is H, which is constant. So A goes as HT. The scale factor you can take to be log A is equal to HT. So by Friedman's equation, the scale factor is E to the HT. In conformal time, so this is going to be it's going to be simplest to work in conformal time. So the conformal time for the general FRW metric d tau is dt over a, so I integrate dt over a, which for this form of a gives minus 1 over h e to the minus ht. It's convenient to choose the because w is equal to minus 1 in the De Sitter metric, and that's less than the magic value of minus 1/3, we expect to have infinite conformal time in the past, finite conformal time in the future. And so it's convenient to choose the 0 so that conformal time runs from minus infinity to 0. Okay. So the metric, I'm working conformal time, the metric is going to be a squared times minus dt squared dx squared. The scale factor in conformal time is just 1 over h tau, minus 1 over h tau. This should have been d tau squared. So in conformal time, the metric here is 1 over h tau squared minus d tau squared plus dx squared. And now if I write the action out with this fixed non-dynamical metric, I get 1 over h tau squared, there's a h tau, there's a 1 over h tau to the fourth in the square root of minus g, and an h tau squared in the inverse metric. 1 over h tau squared times delta phi squared minus del I. Okay. Now, the way that I've formalized things, I only want to talk about harmonic oscillators that go to the canonical form p squared plus omega 0 x squared at early times with no time dependence. And to that means that when I have an action like this, and I want to analyze each Fourier mode of the field in this language, then the first step is always going to be to canonically normalize the field. So canonically normalized just means that you try to write the action in such a way that the coefficient of the phi dot squared term is 1/2. So here it's 1/2 times h tau squared. So in order to get rid of that factor of 1 over h tau squared on the phi dot squared, I just need to define the field sigma equals phi over h tau, and change variables. So if I plug that in, if I think of sigma as the basic quantity instead of phi, then I get this. And now if I, so I've sort of standardized the kinetic term. And now if I want to get rid of the sigma, sigma dot term, then I just integrate by parts. So what I do is I write this term as, you know, to get rid of that, sigma, sigma dot. I write it as 1 over tau times the derivative of sigma squared, and then integrate by parts to get minus plus 1 over tau squared sigma squared. So that gives an extra factor of sigma squared over tau squared, which combines with the factor that's already there to give a coefficient of 2. OK, so this is the canonically normalized action. Since I'm doing the calculation in Hamiltonian language, let me go from the action to the Hamiltonian. The way that works is that you introduce a conjugate momentum field to sigma. And then you do the following procedure. You say that H is, pi is given in terms of sigma dot by the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to sigma dot. And then you define the Hamiltonian by integrating pi sigma dot minus the Lagrangian. So for this action, because it's canonically normalized and it's quadratic, pi is just sigma dot. And when you plug in, you get a sigma dot squared minus what's there. So I just end up, that just ends up switching the sign of everything besides the 1 half sigma dot squared term. Okay. If I write this in Fourier space, it's one little thing. I wrote the action here as sigma dot squared, but since it's a Hamiltonian, I'm supposed to express everything in terms of sigma and pi, not sigma and sigma dot, so let me make that pi squared. So this is in real space. In Fourier space, this looks like sigma k star plus 1/2. Omega squared where omega has this form, k squared minus 2 over tau squared. Okay. So the point of this calculation and this sequence of steps will work for any free field theory, any theory where I just have quadratic terms in phi in the action. I succeed after canonically normalizing as writing the Hamiltonian as a sum over k modes, where each k mode evolves as a time-dependent harmonic oscillator. Oh, yeah, thanks. I have some halves.
This should be.
This is okay, right? Thanks. Okay. I'll add interaction terms in a minute. In this free theory, all that's happening is that each k-mode is behaving as an independent harmonic oscillator. And so it has the solution. Let me put an H here to emphasize that these are Heisenberg picture operators on the left-hand side. Minus k dagger. We could say pi or sigma dot. Let's say pi. I've introduced creation and annihilation operators for each mode of the field with this with the usual commutator. Okay. So V here is the solution of the differential equation V double dot equals minus omega squared. There should have been omega squared here. K squared minus 2 over tau squared. And at early times, meaning tau goes to minus infinity, vk should go to e to the minus I k tau over 2k to the 1. Okay, so that's what this general harmonic oscillator analysis tells me about this free QFT. Now this this differential equation is exactly solvable. I think I mentioned this last time, that in inflationary calculations, or calculations involving De Sitter space, this particular time dependence of the frequency is what you usually get. This isn't supposed to be obvious, but you can check that the solution of this differential equation with these initial conditions is this. So I'll be using this function v fairly frequently. Okay, so okay, so this massless test scalar in De Sitter, by the way, is a somewhat simpler situation than the situation we eventually want to consider, where we have some model of inflation with a dynamical metric, a dynamical field and a dynamical metric. But it's has all the main qualitative features of the full calculations. Okay, so that's the solution of the free QFT in this variable sigma, the canonically normalized field, in the original phi variable. That's just related to sigma by a factor of h tau. So if I put that in, then I can write the Heisenberg, the solution of the evolution of phi and phi dot in in the following way. Just to make later formulas prettier, let me pull out a factor of, it's convenient to pull out a factor of h over 2 to the 1 half k to the 3 halves. And then normalize the time dependence, normalize the mode functions so that they look like this. Let me put the formula for u dot up as well. Okay. So now we know how phi, or you know, by differentiating with respect to tau, phi dot, how that operator evolves with time. And so we've solved the theory, we can compute whatever we want. For example, if you want to calculate the equal time two-point function. One thing I forgot to mention. This harmonic oscillator formalism assumes that I have a bunch of harmonic oscillators which are all starting out in their ground state. Now that's an assumption for this field theory. We're just making the assumption that we start in what's called the Bunch-Davies vacuum, which is the state that you get if you canonically normalize the field and go back to very early times. Early times means a time when all the Fourier modes that you're eventually going to measure all have wavelengths much smaller than the horizon, so that these modes don't realize they live in an expanding universe. Their wavelengths are all much smaller than the horizon, so they just think that they're a free field in Minkowski. And then an assumption is that this free field in Minkowski doesn't have any particle-like excitations. So that's an assumption about inflation that we start in the Bunch-Davies vacuum that you know may or may not be true in our universe, but it's generally assumed when we do inflationary calculations. You know, it's sometimes said that inflation explains where the perturbations come from, but really it just explains the initial conditions. But really it just pushes the problem a little bit further back. If you assume that you start out with no particle-like excitations, then you end up with the correct initial conditions of scale invariant Gaussian field. But it doesn't really explain why you start in that initial Bunch-Davies vacuum. Let me say, however, that it's kind of, although it's not required for any sort of consistency to start in that vacuum, it's a very natural choice. If you try to deviate too much from the Bunch-Davies vacuum, if you start introducing particles, then one problem you might have is that the energy fluctuations associated with those particles back react on the metric and ruin inflation. Another thing that's generally true is that if you start with some fixed density of particle-like excitations, after many e-foldings of inflation, you inflate them away. So it's not the only choice, and indeed there are plenty of papers where people consider other choices. But just to elaborate on this a little bit more, if I have slow roll inflation, and I'm not perfectly on the attractor solution, like let's say I just tunneled out of a false vacuum or something. If that happened recently, where let's say here is the point at inflation where our Hubble scales are crossing the horizon, then that transient event, which inflation eventually washes out, you eventually lock onto the slow roll attractor solution, will look like, if you don't realize this happens and you just measure the state of the universe here, it'll appear to you at like some small deviation from Bunch-Davies. So it's not crazy to consider bunch deviations from Bunch-Davies, but that's what I'm going to assume. So going back to the calculation, if I wanted to calculate, for example, the power spectrum of the field or the two-point function, let's say the expectation value of 2 phi k's equal time. So these are both at time tau. Then I just do the usual Wick's theorem thing. I just take this contraction. So here the rule is that when I contract two fields, I keep the coefficient of A on the left and the coefficient of A dagger on the right with a factor with a delta function that forces the two momenta to be equal. That is just coming from the canonical commutation relation here. So I get a factor of, when I do this contraction, I get a factor of h over 2k cubed to the 1/2 times u. That's the coefficient of a here. And the coefficient of a dagger here is there's another factor of h over 2k cubed times uk star times this delta function. Which has to be there by overall translation invariance. If I just shift the universe over, these operators acquire, by some displacement delta x, these operators acquire phases of e to the I k dot delta x and e to the I k prime dot delta x. And so for the expectation value to be independent of that shift, I have to have this delta function that forces the sum of the two k's to be zero. Okay. So multiplying together the factors of h over 2k cubed and putting in the explicit form of the mode function, here's what I get. This is the equal time correlator at time tau. So I'm actually keeping track in this calculation of the full time dependence of the fluctuation as it's being quantum mechanically generated. If I go to a late time as tau goes to zero, then I just get this. The coefficient of this, so you might notice that things are at late times when the conformal time is greater than minus 1 over k, at times where the co-moving horizon is much smaller than the wavelength of the mode, things are sort of freezing. You can see that if you go back to this mode function for here, phi dot is going to zero at the end of inflation just as an operator. If I compute phi dot by differentiating with respect to tau, put derivatives on the u's, u dot has a derivative in it. U dot has a factor of tau in it, so derivatives of the phi field are going to zero as operators at the end of inflation. The field is freezing. So what I'm describing here is generation of a perturbation, which is frozen at the end of inflation when the wavelengths become much larger than the horizon, and has a two-point correlation function with this characteristic scaling. The size of the fluctuation, the size of the fluctuations is h. This is in Planck units, so that's not right. Field has mass dimension 1, phi has mass dimension 1, so that its fluctuations are of size h. And the 1 over k cubed is what's called scale invariant statistics. So if the power spectrum of k of the field, the function of k that sits in front of the delta function, is proportional to 1 over k cubed, that's what we mean by a scale invariant field. More intuitive way to think about scale invariance is that if I have a random realization of the field in a box, and then I take a small piece of the box and blow it up to the size of the original box, then the field looks statistically indistinguishable from the original. And that just follows, you can prove that statement easily enough, or just note that it follows by dimensional analysis. Power spectra generally have units of volume. For a field with dimensions like phi, they have the dimension of the field squared times the volume. And so if I put in the 1 over k cubed, then I don't need anything else. I don't need a factor here with dimensions. Whereas if I put in a different power of k, I would need some dimensionful quantity in front that would be setting a scale. Okay. By the way, in the field phi, it looks like, so I said things are freezing at the end of inflation. This formula looks a little weird because it looks like things are actually blowing up at the beginning of inflation as I set tau to minus infinity, whereas the physical picture is that I start out with no fluctuations and generate them. In the phi variable, it looks like things are blowing up, but in the canonically normalized field sigma, all that's happening is that the field is staying in its ground state. And I have some fluctuation here which is constant at early times, which just represents the zero-point fluctuations of a harmonic oscillator that are always there in the ground state. If you compute physical quantities, like the energy density associated with these fluctuations. Well, you do get sort of at leading order a formally infinite zero point, sum of zero point energies. But if you subtract that off, you'll get something that is indeed going to zero for a fixed k at early times, and acquiring non-zero values as inflation progresses. Okay, so this is the basic mechanism of how, by starting with no, another thing you can show is that the occupation number of the field, the number of particles in each k mode, is starting out equal to zero. That's the definition of the Bunch-Davies vacuum, and then becoming large toward the end of inflation. So we have evolution to large occupation numbers and classical statistics. So that's the basic mechanism of how on a de Sitter or a near de Sitter expansion, you start out with no particles and generate a random background of many particles with scale invariant statistics. I want to add an interaction to this theory. And I'm going to choose to do a QFT calculation within an interaction. I'm going to choose this kind of weird looking interaction. My interaction Hamiltonian is going to be, I'm going to skip a step where I put an interaction into the Lagrangian and recompute the Hamiltonian, and just assume that I started out with an action. Just assume that I end up with an interaction Hamiltonian that has this particular form. The reason I'm choosing this, so this is kind of a weird looking interaction, phi dot cubed over 1 power of tau. The reason that I chose this particular interaction is not evident at this point, but this is eventually the type of interaction that you'll get for interacting models of inflation, for example, DBI inflation. You get roughly this, I'll show you this later, but let me say in advance that you'll get an interaction of roughly this type. The factor of h cubed is just introduced so that epsilon will be dimensionless. Okay, so all of our previous results working out the time dependence of operators are now results in the interaction picture. So this formula for the time dependence of the operators is still correct. You just have to interpret the left-hand side as being an interaction picture operator. I'm going to calculate the late time three-point function. Where just to make the calculation simpler, I assume that I'm evaluating the expectation value at the end of inflation, which is what will end up being observationally relevant anyway. Okay, so as in the quantum mechanics calculation, there's a phi to minus phi symmetry in the free theory that would prevent this expectation value from getting a non-zero value. But with this cubic interaction, I can have an interesting expectation value. So let's run the NN formalism. So the first order term says I take minus I times this monster expectation value. I commute. These are all interaction picture operators. I commute the observable at time zero With the interaction Hamiltonian at an earlier time tau prime. I forgot the integral. Integral dt prime. This is the interaction picture as well. Okay. This is an expectation value that I can evaluate with Wick's theorem. Let me write this out. So if I so to apply Wick's theorem. So here, in this step, let me do two things at once. So as in the quantum mechanics calculation, the two terms in the commutator just give two pieces that are complex conjugates of each other. So I'm removing the commutator, and I'll put CC at the end. And then in order to apply Wick's theorem, I want everything written in terms of Fourier space interaction picture operators. So if I take this position space cube and just write it as a product of, so if I replace each phi of x by integral of d3 phi k e to the ikx, then I end up with three k integrals, and then the d3x just comes through and puts a delta function. So let me write this. In the following way. Oh, I forgot dots. This should have a dot. These should have dots. Oh, okay. So far, so good. Now let me compute this expectation value using Wick's theorem. So let's enumerate contractions. So one type of contraction you get is the type where each k here pairs off with a k on the right-hand side. There are six such contractions. There are, you know, three factorial ways of reordering the n's here. But they all turn out to be equivalent because, you know, these k's. Oh, I forgot the delta function on the right hand side. I had the sixth sense that was telling me I was forgetting something. There's a delta function in k1 plus k2 plus k3. Okay, so there are six such contractions, but they're all equivalent because the k's on the right-hand side, I should write these as k primes. Because the k primes on the right-hand side are just dummy variables. I could call k1 prime, I could switch the meaning of k1 prime and k2 prime, say. And all six of these contractions are just become equivalent. So I get a, from this type of contraction, I get a factor of minus 6 in front. Minus 6i. Let me pull out the over h cubed. And then I can just do the contraction using Wick's theorem. So for each phi on the left, I get a factor of u evaluated at time 0. I'm just reading this off from the coefficient of A in my free theory solution. There are always these factors of h over 2k cubed to the 1/2. There are going to be six such factors here, one in each phi. So let me just pull all those out and write an overall prefactor of h over h to the sixth over 8k1, k2, k3. Then on the right-hand side, I have u star. I have a u star dot. Integral. Times the delta function. Plus complex conjugate. Okay. Now there's another type of contraction where, just so it's clear, there are delta functions here in the contraction, which you know force each k prime on the right to be equal to minus a k. So this integral comes out, but I'm left with the delta function, now a delta function in k rather than a k prime. So there's another type of contraction where I contract, say, two of these guys on the left-hand side, and then contract you know, this guy with one of these guys and contract two of these guys. So these terms are generally zero, provided that I'm not computing a correlator where any of the phis goes to zero momentum. So let me just assume that an assumption in this calculation is that all the ki's are non-zero. The reason that would be true is that if I have a contraction with this combinatorial type, then so this contraction forces k1 to be minus k2. Oh, sorry, let me start from this side. So this contraction forces k2 prime to be minus k3 prime. Then this delta function would force k1 prime to be 0. And then since that's contracting with a k3 on the left-hand side, that forces k3 to be 0. So provided, so one way of saying it is that the contractions of these type all come with the delta function and say k3 by itself, and so they give 0. Okay. Now I just have to do this integral. If I write out if I plug in the mode functions explicitly, I get this. This should have been cubed. Times the integral of d tau prime over tau prime so the u's are just going to 1, or I guess there's this factor of minus I that never appears because you always end up with equal numbers of u's and u stars. So because because I'm evaluating the three-point function at time 0, these u's don't contribute. The u dots each contribute, you know, their respective k squared times a tau times e to the minus I k tau. So on the right-hand side here, I just end up with, you know, three factors of k squared times a tau prime cubed times e to the I some ki. That's too soon. Okay. So if you think about this integral, it's an oscillatory integral. If you think about the integrand and the tau prime plane, I'm integrating from minus infinity to zero. I'm integrating something which is oscillatory times a power of tau prime squared. So this integral is, you know, badly non-convergent on the real axis. But as usual in field theory, you usually have to wick rotate to a Euclidean time to make integrals converge. So all that's going on here is that because each of the k's is positive, this integral converges in the positive imaginary direction in the complex plane. So if I rotate, if I keep this end of the contour fixed, that tau prime equals zero, and wick rotate up to the positive imaginary axis, the integral will converge. In other words, I just define a Euclidean conformal time by tau prime equals minus I tau e prime. Tau e prime is a variable that also runs from minus infinity to zero. And make that change of variables, and I'll get a convergent integral. Okay, so making that change of variables. I get just wondering. Okay. I got a little confused because the constant factor I have in my notes is not the same as the constant factor on the board, but I believe that my notes actually have the error. So let me just keep going. Okay, so I have a... constant prefactor after this wick rotation. I'll get a constant prefactor of 3/4. Times the epsilon h cubed k1, k2, k3 times the Euclidean time integral this integral where I have x squared, let me write that down as a separate formula. So if I have the integral of x squared times e to the ax, where a is a positive number, then it's not difficult to do the integration by parts. Another way of saying it is that this is a gamma function, this integral is 2 over a cubed. For a general power of x to the n in front, it would be 1 over a to the n plus 1 by dimensional analysis times an n factorial, because when I integrate x to the n times e to the x, I always get a gamma function, I always get n factorial. Okay. So putting that in, I get a factor of 2. I get 3/3. Let me also get rid of the cc, since I just ended up with a real number in the end. I can just put in a factor of 2. In the complex conjugate term, by the way, you would have had to wick rotate in the other direction. You would have ended up with factors of e to the minus I ki tau prime, you would have done the Wick rotation in the other direction, but you would still end up with a complex conjugate in the end. So that gets rid of the factor of 4, and I get 3h cubed over k1, k2, k3 times, let's see. Let me actually keep the 4 here just so it's less confusing and write the center rule as 2 over sum of the k's cubed. Okay, so including the CC as a factor of 2 and combining everything, the final result is 3h cubed over k1, k2, k3, k1 plus k2 plus k3 cubed. Times the delta function, which I started dropping at some point. So let me just put it in here at the end. So I didn't really motivate this calculation, although I am going to use the result later. We'll have a model of inflation whose action, when we work it out, will be the starting point of this calculation. But if you just accept this form of the interaction Hamiltonian, then this is the three-point function that you get at inflation, at the end of inflation. And if you had this in the fluctuations of our universe, it would be a non-Gaussian observable you could use for. In fact, this is almost the same thing as the cosmological parameter, which is sometimes denoted F, conventionally denoted F and L equilateral. I'll talk about this more next time. Okay, that was a good timing. That's all for today. I'm gonna give you, for the tutorial, I think, a different version of this calculation with a different interaction that we'll eventually find corresponds to a different cosmological parameter. Thanks.